Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome, everybody, to this edition of Voice Rebellion Radio. This is your host, Chris J. It is 11 o'clock a.m. Eastern Time here in St. Pete. This is a pre-record for the Sunday night edition of Voice Rebellion. So if you're listening tonight, this is a little bit before, but it is a new show nonetheless. And tonight we are talking about the situation in Syria, Ukraine, Venezuela. Pretty much it's like a mixed show today, and we're going to be talking about a few other current events. Syria, things have been heating up as the Wahhabi forces still continue to try to take territory, and there's been some pretty fierce battles between the Syrian Arab Army and the Wahhabi forces. The rebels who have been backed by the United States for multiple years now have been persistent in trying to keep the war going, even though they've been practically cornered deep into the deserts as they have lost pretty much every major city in Syria. They still tried to cling on to a lot of territory out in the middle of the desert, and they still hold Raqqa, even though that's officially held by ISIS. But when I say the rebels, ISIS included, because it's pretty much one loose conglomeration of terrorists versus the Assad military. And we've seen now the United States has given direct air support twice to the Syrian rebels, and that's really all official that we know. We don't know how many unofficial United States airstrikes have been in favor of the rebels, and we've seen the media shift the narrative, and now it's no longer that, oh, we might be able to not have regime change, we're just trying to bring it into the war. Now it's that there's definite need for regime change. Trump seems to be definitely on board for regime change, and you know that most of the neocon cabinet is on board with regime change. Syria is one of Russia's closest allies, but if Russia and Trump want to get along, Trump's obviously not going to be able to intervene in Syria. And that's where the whole Trump-Russia narrative falls apart, because I see Trump and how he's pissing off Russia in many different ways. I believe that if he really wanted to please Russia, he wouldn't have done these things. And you see that Trump actually has taken a pro-Kiev stance in the whole Ukraine situation, and Trump has taken a hardline stance against the Venezuelan government, one of Russia's allies over here in the Western Hemisphere. I think that Trump, just like Obama, just like many other presidents, that they act like there was going to be a significant change in their foreign policy, and then when he became president, the forces that are in power of this country wouldn't let him. And I think that Trump, though, I don't think he was ever like somebody that was outside the establishment. I think Trump has always been part of the establishment. He's always been one of the billionaires that lobbies for the system to be the way it is. And you see is that America voted in one of the most, ruthless lobbyers and, one of the most just kind of a face of the billionaire-ran system that America is in. And, I said voted. It was selected by the Rothschilds. Donald Trump got a lot of support from even people in the alternative media thinking he was going to be different, thinking that Donald Trump was going to fix our foreign policy, fix our policy with corporations taking advantage of American workers, and also potentially even in the Fed. Now we realize that none of these things are going to happen, and also some of the more less rational reasons people voted for Trump, such as the wall, we realize the wall is not going to get built. Is that realizing that Trump's just an ultimately another neocon president, no different than the last two. And people are coming to that harsh reality, and I think that some people have yet to come to that harsh reality, but that's the way it is. And with Syria, that's been an exemplification of all of this. The fact that in Syria, the Trump administration has taken the exact same stance as Obama and actually has done more than Obama did when it comes to direct action, is that now we have known direct airstrikes on the Syrian army. We had an accidental one last year in September. We had the Deir ez-Zor attack that killed 106 Syrian soldiers, which I don't believe was an accident. We've had also other things that happened before the Trump administration, of course, that were against the Syrian military. But now the direct approach against the Syrian military that's being advertised on TV really shows that there's a big shift towards the dormancy of the United States military machine in Syria. But the fact is that it seemed like they would have been in long ago, maybe 4 years ago, when we had the 2013 standoff about the chemical weapons and there was a supposed chemical weapon attack on Damascus. It looked like the United States military would go in then. But they didn't. And then they kind of snuck in the next year under the guise of fighting this new terrorist group, ISIS. Now they've been there about 3 years doing this, you know, so-called the coalition has been there. Now the coalition is starting to move their targets away from ISIS and now towards the Syrian military. It seems like that's what the media is now showing, is that that they're attacking the Syrian military. And the coalition is, I think soon, is probably going to make some kind of major move against the Syrian military. And I think that, you know, really just going to take one more false flag. We saw, you know, and we see all these more and more false flags as time progresses. And I don't, when I mean false flag, I don't mean like, you know, that these are actors and no one actually dies in these. These are just, you know, frame-ups totally, that there's nobody actually got killed. There's no, I'm not saying that. When I say a false flag, unfortunately, that's what a lot of times happens with a false flag, is that people are massacred for agenda. And that's why I think like what happened at 11, 13, 15 in Paris, when those like 100 people got gunned down, I don't think that people didn't die. I think that people did die. I just think that the people that perpetuated weren't rogue terrorists. I think they were part of a larger intelligence group. I think that they belonged to, honestly, the Mossad. It seems to be the eyewitness accounts that they were like three white men getting out of a car. Also, the band thought that the security was in on it. I think one more big false flag and the American public would be jumping to support a war in Syria, a war in Iran. And that's what the war in Syria is ultimately a doorway to going into Iran. And, you know, some people say that's even one more step towards going to Russia. But I think that the United States is going to hold off on striking Russia anytime soon, considering the fact they don't have quite the firepower to do so yet. The Russian military has definitely advanced from the time of the 90s. They are very powerful military, and the United States military is not going to be able to quite handle it yet, especially when the fact that they have all these failed projects. They're going to have to probably rebuild the military, you know, like Trump said, even though the military already spends more money than any other military on the planet. They're probably, you know, I'm talking about, they're going to try to get more work and stuff, more equipment. As we've seen, is that they, the United States military definitely isn't at its finest point. And I think that the part of the Trump agenda is to get Americans, you know, with this ultra-patriotic attitude in order to supporting a more money being spent on the military. As we've seen, is that he talks about how we need to rebuild the military, and Trump is definitely the generalissimo for the United States, is that he resembles a character like Franco or Salazar or many other fascist dictators in the past that can use their big, macho, larger-than-life character in order to push militarism. And, you know, the other thing is Obama didn't really fit that character when going into World War III, is the fact that Obama wouldn't be seen as somebody that could lead a country through war. His demeanor was kind of, people joked at it. People joked at his insane, you know, insane, sometimes, you know, the way, uncertainty in the way they spoke. His attitude, people joked at it. You know, it didn't seem like president, but Trump seems like somebody that's trying to get things done. Seems like somebody that's like a businessman, a man on a mission. And I don't support Trump, obviously, but I see that Trump's character is more what the American people perceive as strong. And even though at this point he has very low approval ratings, I believe that a war in Syria or war somewhere is going to probably boost him, as he's going to be seen as the man to lead us through that. You know, the last president that, you know, we had, like, you know, For example, we have Woodrow Wilson, who I don't think was that very popular when he came in as president, but he was able to stay in all the way up to 1920, two terms, because of the war and because he led us through one of our toughest times of American history. Even though the Woodrow Wilson was ultimately one of the most corrupt, you know, when it comes to sort of gauge corruptness, when you're talking about all these presidents that ultimately all are Fed puppets. However, Woodrow Wilson was the president that ultimately signed the Federal Reserve Act. He's the one that the Federal Reserve ultimately put in order for him to do that, in order for him to sign our country off to billionaires and the Rothschilds and all these big families, the industrial families, the Morgans, the Rockefellers, all these top families were able to pretty much take control of the United States via the signing of the Federal Reserve Act. That's pretty much what happened, is that our country was sold off to a private bank, private shareholders. And with Woodrow Wilson having done that, you know, that's kind of, I wonder if Donald Trump, probably the major thing that's going to be when it comes to pushing their agenda, it'll be martial law. I believe that Donald Trump will do that here in the United States when at some point in his presidency. I could see the way that he has a callous tone towards using the military to police. You know, when he talked about there was that tweet about how he was going to handle the Chicago situation. I think that he could be the one that puts the troops out in the streets. And some people will theorize that will be the United States military. Some people theorize it will be the United Nations military. I think it could be a combination of both. They'll be out in the streets when the martial law begins. And I don't like to be an alarmist, but I really see it happening this year, later this year at some point. Along with the war breaking out in Syria. But then again, it seems like everything's been delayed. Because, you know, Wesley Clark talked about in that speech about 7 countries in 5 years, and now it's been 10 years and they haven't even gotten to like the 5th country on that list. So perhaps maybe it'll be a few more years before we actually go into the war with Iran and Syria, or some people even say North Korea. Even though I don't know if North Korea will ever get struck, because they have the nuclear deterrent. They have something that Iraq never had, the nuclear deterrent. Iran may or may not have nuclear weapons, even though they've been saying that they've had nuclear weapons for 30 years. There's no proof that they have nuclear weapons. It doesn't seem that they have nuclear weapons. Syria does not have nuclear weapons, so the deterrent's not quite as there for the United States to go into those two countries. However, when it comes to North Korea, there's a deterrent for sure. And the fact that they have arsenals that can hit all over South Korea and Japan. Now, would they do it? That's the question. Are they crazy enough to do it? You know, that's maybe something that none of us can answer, but I think that's enough deterrent possibly for the United States military not to touch those countries. In the United States military, right now the target's mainly on Iran and Syria. Those are the countries that are on Wesley Clark's list. They've been the countries that the Rothschilds want to mark off their list for multiple years now. When it comes to, they took out Afghanistan, they took out Iraq, they took out Libya, and they took out the Sudan. Now they want to take out Iran and Syria. And there's one more country on that list. I think with Yemen. And Yemen's it's an interesting situation now, because part of the country is controlled by the Houthis, that are a pro-Shia, anti-American group. And then there's a bunch of the countries controlled by the ex-government that used to be supportive of the United States. So right now, technically, you could say that that Yemen is actually hasn't been marked off the list yet. So it's like I said, they even didn't even get to the 5th country on the list after how many years? Now, it's been 10 years. It was 2007 was when the speech was made. And now we have they're just talking about potentially may go into Iran eventually. I remember like 5 years ago, it seemed like the United States was going to go to Iran at any point. It seemed like a war with Iran was very imminent. And, you know, it seemed like there was new talk all the time. Benjamin Netanyahu brought out his little cartoon drawing about the how close Iran was to a nuclear weapon. Obama was talking pretty tough on Iran. That was one of the major things after the 2012 election was the Iran discussion. Who had a more hardline stance about Iran. I remember those both, that was really just a perfect exemplification of the fake elections when Romney, Obama, how similar they were, how much they agreed on, and ultimately it all came down to how hardline they were on some stances. And when it came to foreign policy, both vilified Russia, both vilified Iran. Romney tried to like take the stance of that Obama was too weak on these issues or whatnot. Remember back to that election, you know, is that ultimately it was just like the perfect candidate to lose to Obama. You know, they selected Obama for another term. Now, Obama was there for his whole 8 years, which I think was kind of unexpected for a lot of people. That's why I think this is going to happen with Trump, that despite the fact of his unpopularity in his first term and a lot of calls to impeach him, I think that Trump's going to be there for a second term. You know, some people think that within the first year that he's going to get impeached. And they think that already, because, you know, a congressman called for his impeachment, that he's going to be impeached soon. So I highly doubt it. And even if he is impeached, it's not going to be much better for us. We have Mike Pence as the president. People don't realize that all these government positions, they are players of the same game. So even if you went down to the eighth person on the list, it's still going to be another shithead. All down the list. There's puppets. Puppets playing for the Rothschilds, playing for the New World Order. And, you know, people, during this election, people fell into the anti-establishment versus establishment game. People actually believed that there were anti-establishment candidates. And they believed that, for example, they believed that Donald Trump was anti-establishment. They believed that Ted Cruz, even tried to put that label on him. They actually believed that Bernie Sanders is anti-establishment, when there was no real evidence by the way they talked, by the foreign policy, by their domestic policy, that they were anti-establishment. And, you know, Donald Trump, he put a little bit of that rhetoric in his campaign. Bernie Sanders, he really came, if you heard his foreign policy, was not much different than really any modern-day politician. And a lot of the modern-day politicians try to act like they're against war. Obama tried to act like he was against war. And then ultimately, we were in 7 wars at one point during the Obama administration, which actually was like 4 more than Bush ever was in. So people were heavily disappointed because, you know, they were trying to escape the Bush years and what went down in the Bush years, and then ultimately they voted in Obama and it was the same shit. And that's what's happened with Trump right now. Trump is another repeat of Barack Obama when it comes to the anti-establishment figure having not living up to his expectations, not living up to what people voted him for. And a lot of people are very disappointed with Trump, and apparently, I mean, his support base has shrunk down. I mean, there's like, what, he's going to have already potentially one of the lowest approval ratings of any president in his first year, which usually presidents in the first year have a naturally positive approval ratings, and then usually by their last year, they fall off. You know, Bush had abysmal approval ratings by the end of 2008. Obama's approval ratings were pretty low by the end of 2016. I feel like Trump, it might be the same way in 2024. So I wonder if there will even be elections in 2024. Sometimes I even wonder if there will be elections in 2020. You know, people are talking about voting the 2020 election for Tulsi Gabbard or Bernie Sanders again. And I can't help but think that probably martial law ought to be declared, and there's a possibility that we might not even have an election at that point. I mean, some people thought that Obama, there would never be a 2012 election or a 2016 election. I remember some people thought that Obama was going to stay in for a third term, or they was going to somehow change the Constitution so he would still be in now for a third term. I think there was a bill that was floated on the floor for a short time. There's been a few of them before where they're like trying to raise presidential term limits, and then he would stay for three terms or whatever. How many times he got voted in, or quotation voted in, but I think they realized it would generate too much controversy, so they just decided to go to a new puppet, which was Donald Trump. Even though the Donald Trump, he seems to have generated enough controversy himself, but he's fitting an agenda, divide and conquer. He said he's dividing, made two of the most polarized segments of American society, and causing a lot of division in this country. And that seems to be what they're doing right now. They're capitalizing on the large division, the large separation between the two segments of American society. You have your social justice warriors, well, not the two segments, but two different segments of American society. The social justice warriors versus, I guess you could say the two segments of American society, social justice warriors versus alt-right. Right now, the political dominance that these two groups have when it comes to public opinion, they're capitalizing on. And, they've also, it's like the left-right paradigm. That the people, they have people fighting over, they have Democrats are believed to be far left to Republicans, and Republicans are believed to be far right to Democrats, but ultimately the same. They're of the same political – they're both in the far right, really. I mean, think about it. They both support the merger of corporate and state power. They're both fascists, and they both believe in curtailing their liberties. They believe in more foreign wars, more spying on American citizens. You go on and on and on. But neither party stands for liberty. Neither party stands for the average worker, against the corporation, even though the Democrats try to play like that, but they try to play like they're for raising the minimum wage and also for holding corporations accountable for exploiting workers. But nothing got done on Obama. Nothing got done on Clinton. Nothing ever gets done. That's with anything that really any politician says in America, is that ultimately in the end, nothing ever gets done. Nothing ever gets they just ultimately end up following the same game, the same game plan as always. But, by the way, anybody that wants to call in, the call-in number right now is over here, 845-277-9223. 845-277-9223. Voice of Rebellion Radio here, early broadcast, 11 a.m. Sunday. And I'll try to keep people more posted on the future times where I do these early broadcasts or whatever, so I can bring more people, call in and stuff like that, because I don't get too many listeners why I want to do this, because I have it on Blog Talk Radio. But I'll try to let more people know down the road, and what I'm doing, and they could call in, listen live. And also, I mean, there is, of course, listening on UCY, the ultimate home of Voice Rebellion Radio, at 9 o'clock tonight, also on YouTube later. But it's always good, I think, to listen to a show live, and, it's like I've been kind of alternating between doing live shows and doing shows early in the day, Sunday, or doing a Thursday, or recording the shows for different reasons, and, I was thinking, since I've got the Blog Talk radio membership, I was hoping that I'd eventually be getting more guests or whatever, because, it's early. I can get guests from other time zones across the world compared to just, it's kind of hard to get guests on. For example, when it's 10 o'clock, 9 o'clock Eastern time, I'm trying to get guests in Ireland, at 1 a.m., that's pretty difficult. You know, it's 1 a.m., and then by the time the show wraps up, it's 3 a.m. Eastern time. And, you know, talk about even further away, you know, it's like if you go to you go over to like Russia and stuff like that, 9 hour difference, you know, it's like 6 a.m. when the show's starting. So get people from over there on, you know, they have to be on 6 to 8 in the morning. A lot of people won't do that. So it's more convenient to do something like right now, where it's like 6 o'clock at night there. I mean, Blog Talk Radio, though, of course, I think there's some disadvantages to the whole thing. For the fact that they have to pay $40 a month, not the best quality podcasting platform. There's definitely better ones out there. This is one I'm familiar with, one I've used before. I used to use this back when I was on Stable Radio. It was like the main station for Voice of Bone Radio, which that's actually where we're broadcasting right now, from Stable Radio and Blog Talk Radio. Voice of Bone Radio's started there back in 2014, and then, you know, the original station that Voice of Billing was out of was NWO Truth Radio since 2013. So now we've been actually on the air for getting close to 4 years. Pretty surprising. But no people listening right now. Yeah, definitely. What's going on in Syria right now? It's definitely, the situation has changed. The situation, they went from the went from a more covert, you know, sneaking around, you know, little strikes here and there, or, you know, boots on the ground here and there. Now it seems to be that the pushing, the beats of war are starting to drum, and you can hear it slowly nearing that. Within a few months, we're going to see big calls on Congress, big calls on the Senate, that kind of thing, to remove Assad. Similar to like when they tried to remove Saddam in 2003, and then eventually successful. That same kind of, you know, that he may or may not have WMDs, or that he that he's a threat to the world, like the threat to say Saddam was. And you have to remember, Saddam was placed by the United States government into the position of power that he had. Saddam would have been nobody if it wasn't for the United States government. As the fact is that they propped them up in the 80s, they gave them a lot of weapons to fight Iran. Iraq invaded Iran in the 1980s. And also, the United States was also involved with the whole shenanigans on the other side with supplying arms to Iran at the same time. By arming both sides of the war in the way they did. I mean, the United States military did help create one of the most bloodiest conflicts in the Middle East history. Like, over 1 million people died during the Iraq-Iran war, and people, it seems to be kind of forgotten about in history. And now the Syrian war is now up there. You know, we have hundreds of thousands of dead, and the United States supporting these Wahhabi terrorist groups that have resulted in so many people being killed. You know, and they talk about the Free Syrian Army, but there's also, we know openly that guns have gotten into groups like Tahrir al-Sham, a.k.a. al-Nusra Front, has landed into what used to be known as the Islamic Front, Ahrar al-Sham, which I think they openly support the United States, but they get open support from Qatar, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, and al-Nusra, that is pretty much, is ultimately al-Qaeda. And then there's ISIS, which ISIS, they try to make it seem like it's a totally different front of the war, but ultimately ISIS is fighting alongside the Free Syrian Army. There's a ceasefire, I believe, between the Free Syrian Army and ISIS, And then there's the Kurdish groups that are also involved in the war that Russia supports and at the same time the United States supports. You have the question, I think it's the United States is trying to splinter away the Kurds from the rest of Syria and are trying to Balkanize the country, and that's why they're supporting the Kurds as they do. It's not really that they care about the Kurdish people and the Kurdish fight against ISIS and you know, the Syrian government and the Kurds have been generally allies, I think, throughout the war. They've been, I'm pretty sure, attacked by a lot of the rebel groups, as the rebel groups target minorities in the country. And looking at the, you know, you see all these different countries that support, you know, it's like, it's pretty one-sided. When you look at different countries that support the rebels compared to the different countries that support the government. We have Turkey, one of America's closest allies, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, France, very close American allies. Of course, the United States itself, Libya. And then in the coalition, there's the United States, France, UK, Netherlands, Australia, Jordan, Germany, Norway, and there used to be Canada, Bahrain, Denmark, Belgium, Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, Qatar, Morocco. It's pretty much, it's all American allies. And, you know, all we hear about the rebels, all we hear about the Syrian war is from our news. So we've been led to believe that the Syrian rebels are freedom fighters, that they're fighting the oppressed of Assad regime, that a country was held hostage by this dictator for so many years. And then you read about what actually went on in Syria before the war, and it seemed like it was a very modern country. It was a very prospering modern country with a lot of modern things that, you know, maybe some of the other Middle Eastern countries didn't even have. And then a lot of this has been taken away since the war has happened. And now, and, you know, there's a couple interesting things about, you know, the placement of some of these rebel forces in the country. For example, there's been a pocket throughout the war right near the border of the Golan Heights, which is controlled by Israel, of ISIS, that stayed right at the border. And they've been there, you know, now the pocket shrunk down. But then you look at almost the entire border is in green, to the rebels, and then there's some pockets of white, which is al-Nusra, I believe. So right now you see like swarming around Aleppo rebels and al-Qaeda around homes. There's some rebels al-Qaeda. You know, Damascus seems to be one of the few places where government seems to be totally in control of the area and the area surrounding it. And then you have Palmyra. The government recently retook Palmyra. This little pocket where Deir ez-Zor, which is surrounded by a lot of ISIS, but the Syrian Arab armies held on to that one city. But then the big push that people have talked about is the eventual push towards Raqqa, which right now is not too far from Kurdish territory. And I guess there's a possibility that maybe even the Kurdish might be able to push down and retake the city away from ISIS. So that's when ISIS's influence over the country shrunk. I think the Syrian government is reclaiming a lot of influence that it had towards eastern Syria. Also, the Kurdish, I mean, they control practically all of northern Syria, which includes, like, major cities such as Ohavska, let's see, Kobani, of course. Kobani, that's where there was a very large battle that happened between ISIS and the Kurdish forces back in 2014, right about the time that the coalition joined in the war. Right on the Turkish border. And that's the thing is that it's been shown that the Turkish have been allowing ISIS to cross back into Syria via their country. They've even said there's an ISIS consulate in Turkey. You could even buy like ISIS merchandise in Turkey. Turkey's support of ISIS is pretty much open, and it's the only country only American ally where that's really been brought out into the open about. And that might be the only American ally where it seems like their leader has actually been somewhat criticized, I guess, by the media. Was President Erdogan has been kind of shown to be a dictator, but which he is a dictator. He's been there almost 20 years, and the people don't want him there. There's been a huge protest. There was he shut down major sites off the internet a few times. Erdogan definitely stifles dissent in his country, and is definitely no friend of democracy. And now he has after that presidential referendum, it gave him even more power, unprecedented power over his country. It's funny how they don't criticize Erdogan, but Assad actually has been there less time. And you could say that Assad received his power illegitimately, and that's why that he's been criticized by Erdogan, received it legitimately. I'm pretty sure that Turkey, the way that they get power in that country, is no more legitimate than the way that often Syrian leaders get power, with coups, and I think they've had like 4 coups in Turkish history. While Assad, he got his power through his father. And it was actually his brother supposed to take power back in 2000, but he died in 1994. So when his father died, he took over. Assad was going to be an eye doctor and really didn't have much interest in politics. But then he returned back to the country and kind of got groomed to become the president of Syria. And then when his father died, he took place. Hafez al-Assad, who had been there for 30 years, they've been there since 1970, and then ultimately this party altogether, the Baath Party, the one that the Assad family belongs to, which is an Arab socialist party. It's a party that believes in sovereignty for Arab countries, and all at the same time believes like an Arab-born socialism, not like a Marxism-Leninism. The party had been in power since 1963, which that means it's been about 54 years. There was, at one point, I believe there was a like pro-Soviet government that was in Syria. And then there was a coup, which led to another coup or something like that. I mean, that's the thing about the history of the Middle East, is that you see coup after coup, war after war, civil war replacing another government. I know that they had a pro-Soviet government in Iraq in the 1950s, I think it was Qasim was the leader that was killed in 1965 or something by the Baath Party there, which was a whole different Baath Party practically. The Iraqi Baath Party was very authoritarian and really wasn't about principles of socialism or sovereignty, more just really about a strongman complex. Now, I said that a lot of the Iraqi Baath Party members have joined ranks of ISIS after the war ended. So it was totally different. The United States supported Saddam and the Iraqi Baath Party, and apparently it's still, active. I don't know if that's still technically active, actually, but I think it's kind of got grouped into ISIS nowadays, which they're fighting, as they believe, I guess, American aggression or something like that. The party leaders don't believe that. I mean, the party members, the people, low level, the grunts of the party, but I don't think that the leader or whatever actually believes that as ultimately they're pretty much being used as American pawns, and their government actually became pretty pro-Iran. So I think that's part of the reason why these people have joined ISIS, is that they see this as the way to combat the Iranian influence in Iraq. Some people even try to make it seem like Baghdad became like a governor capital of Tehran, Also, another thing about the bosses that, of course, they were anti-Kurdish, and the current government of Iraq is pretty Kurd-friendly. So, yeah, they're going to be probably looking at any way to take down that current leadership. But ultimately, it all started, I mean, the whole idea of bossism actually was not a bad idea at first, and it came about from the 1940s, and it was the idea of sovereignty for Arab countries, opposing both Soviet communism and the Western way. And then, you know, in Iraq, it formed into something ugly, but in Syria, I would say it's really like the modern version of the Baath system. And while Syria, fortunately, their whole model has been heavily affected by the war. And all the destruction came with it. Years of terrorist attacks. When it comes to Syria, it was a pretty decent country to live in, I think, until the war happened. You see pictures of it, and you see Damascus. It looks like more like New York City than it resembles a, you know, what we think of a Middle Eastern country. What we think, you know, us Americans, we have very preconceived notions of what the countries around the world look like. You know, we have, and I think the thing that would be surprised by Latin America, a lot of those countries, you know, the cities look like European cities, American cities. They're not all slums. That's what they would think, you know, a South American city would look like. They think an African city would look very poor and a lot of shacks and stuff like that. But ultimately, there's very nice parts of these cities, you know, over there in Africa. Asia, I think they understand those are look pretty high-tech, those cities nowadays. Shanghai and all those, Seoul, they all are very advanced. They pass the Americans advanced. The United States, our cities have our, you know, like our infrastructure. Our infrastructure is shit. I mean, we are 100 years past all of this stuff, and this is not what we're focusing our money on. We're focusing our money on bombing another country. It's another one of our priorities that we need to focus on. And I think it was part of the appeal of Trump was that he was talking about the infrastructure, he was talking about stuff that politicians don't usually talk about, that we needed to fix our country. And that should be stressed, that we need to fix our country and we need to stop dealing with American foreign policy. We need to stop giving money to Israel. They're fine, but our country's not. Our country has a lot of problems. There's a problem with our infrastructure. We need to fix drug epidemic in this country. We need to, at the same time, we need to upgrade a lot of our systems. And, you know, universal healthcare system wouldn't hurt either. And people think that universal healthcare is a nightmare creation of big government. But we have already a nightmare big government, and healthcare is not a signal of that. Healthcare is the universal healthcare, the idea that everyone isn't, you know, should get healthcare when they're sick. And it's not the idea that, you know, that you should be able to hold a gun to a doctor or whatever and say, treat me. No, because they're getting paid by billionaires and the people that have ransacked this country. That's the way that they can start paying back those healthcare systems and that kind of thing. And, you know, people say that's theft. But when it comes to, you know, billionaires, that's what the thing is that people think that it's kind of weird how people have sympathy for billionaires and ultra-rich people. These people are stolen. These people have definitely taken advantage. They've taken advantage of different rules in our system. Maybe not every single one of them, but the grand majority for sure. You know, when you talk about getting to $1 billion, it definitely takes some shady tactics to get to that point. I mean, to get to $1 million is hard, but it's literally 1,000 times that to get to $1 billion. And then you have people that are past $10 billion. You have people that are nearing $100 billion. And then you have, you know, the last shelf and shit, they're in the trillions. Forbes, you know, doesn't even list some of these people because they're trying to keep them in the shadows, trying to keep the people that really rule this country in the shadows, so we don't know about them. So we don't ask questions. How do these people get to that kind of money? Well, they absolutely control the money, would be the answer. When you print the currency, then you can actually when you print the currency, then ultimately what you have, it's not even, what even is the number for that? You know, there's not any there's not really any set number at that point. These people, you know, it's like, that's why it's talked about that they might be in the around 10 trillion, might even be in the hundreds of trillions of Rothschild net worth when you count all their banks and everything. Somewhere between $300 to $700 trillion, I think, $500 to $700 trillion is what the Rothschilds own. It's crazy. And a lot, you know, and a lot of people don't even know who the Rothschilds are. I didn't know who the Rothschilds were until I was 14. And it was lucky that I did some research or whatever, but I know there's a lot of people that very easy to stay blind to stuff like that for your entire life. Or you might have heard the name Rothschild, but you don't really know who they are. It's like I knew who the Rothschilds were. I heard the name before, but I had no clue what that meant. You know, I was just knew they were a rich family. I didn't know that they were maybe the most powerful family on the planet. And, you know, researching into who they are, it's repulsing. What their banks have been responsible for, what they've been behind, millions of people killed on their watch. And it's not an exaggeration. Millions of people have died at the hands of the Rothschilds, via the wars they funded, via the dictators they've supported, via the revolutions, in quotations, that they backed. Some people that they say they backed the 1917 Civil War in Russia, you know, that they definitely helped form the State of Israel. That's 6 million people there killed alone. But all the Palestinians have been killed since 1948. They back Nazi Germany. That's another 11 million killed in the Holocaust. And you think, well, they're Jewish. Why would they back the Nazis? Because of the money. They don't care about the Jewish compatriots. And when it comes to Zionism, Zionism has a history working with Nazism. As we saw with the Havar Agreement, if you haven't checked that out, look that up. Or it's also called the Transfer Agreement. The Nazis and the Zionists have collaborated together in the past. And people think that's crazy. And look at today. Who's the second biggest financer of the Kiev regime? That's going to be Israel. The Israeli government backs the Kiev regime, backs the genocide that's going against the ethnic Russians of the with the people there. That's why Crimea, you know, that's why it was annexed by the Russians. It was because the Russians are power hungry and are concerned about taking all this territory and whatnot. It's because the Russians want to protect their own people there. And you see the Russians are trying to put all their restraint not going into Ukraine. If they want to, they definitely have a justification to go into East Ukraine and take back the entire Donbass region. But they don't, because if they do, that would start World War III. The Syrian military, you know, that's part of the reason why ultimately, you know, the wars went on this long. That's because I think the Russians could intervene totally and were to, you know, start shooting down United States airplanes that get too close or whatever, then the war could be over a long time ago. But then again, it would probably blow up into a much huger war. But, you know, the Russians, they only sent in a little small amount of soldiers in order to deal with the situation. They didn't send in hundreds of thousands or even 12,000. They sent in like 1,500 soldiers. Now, they have pretty high-tech weapons. I mean, you see the Russians also, they do large amounts of airstrikes against ISIS, and that's why ISIS had been pushed out into the desert, so that they're losing the war. The Russians have made that very clear that they're not going to win this war and eventually be pushed into obscurity. And you see, like, even like some of the rebel groups have now even like tried to sign agreements with the Russians and stuff like that, because they know that ultimately nothing's going to keep them. They rather just, you know, try to sign for mercy or whatever and avoid being annihilated as a whole, as the Russians have shown that, you know, they can do. You know, they did not, way back in the 1940s, they did to the Nazis, that they pushed them into obscurity. They pushed them all the way back to Berlin and when it came to the ideology of Nazism, it was practically, you know, non-existent for many years in Europe after World War II. Now, of course, there was some major problems also in the Soviet government. There were some major problems in the Soviet Union. But what they did to defeat Nazism can't be ignored. Even though the United States likes to ignore it, they try to act like they're the sole defeaters of Nazism, and that ultimately that the United States was the ultimate victor of the war. And, you know, in some ways you can say that the Soviet Union, they took major loss in the war. They lost 27 million people. It's kind of hard to say that you won anything when you lose that many people. Tens of millions were killed. Germany, they lost millions as well. The United States only lost about 500,000 soldiers, which is still horribly unfortunate. But when it comes to some of the other countries, it was not that large of a role. I mean, 27 million. I think the Chinese lost like 10 million. It's forgotten about their huge role to defeating the Japanese and the horrible torture that some of the Japanese put these Chinese through. The Japanese fought against China in World War II. That's another reason why this war was so massive, was that China and Japan fought, Russia and Germany fought, the United States was there, Germany attacking England, Germany attacking France. You think about what that'd be like today in modern times. It's crazy. All these major powers fighting each other. And it's almost, it's a little bit unnerving when you see, for example, like when China and Japan get tense with each other, you worry about the possibility that another war between those two could break out. Another war between the West or in the, between the West and Russia could break out. Or a Western country. Between a Western country that's striving to put more influence against Russia. You know, for example, with like Nazi Germany, was, you know, kind of like that, I guess you could say, was the West European power that fought against Russia in World War II, and then there was Napoleon way back to fight against Russia in the Napoleonic Wars. It's one of the forgotten wars that, you know, it's like people a lot of times try to act like there's only been, you know, two world wars. You know, it's kind of a, really, it's something that almost can be laughed at, because think about it, it's Napoleonic Wars that killed almost as many people as World War I. You know, they had the 6 Years' War, the 1700s, and then how many times did France and Britain fight throughout the medieval times all the way up? You know, there's been these wars going on for 1,000 years. It's just that we haven't had one in 70 years now. And, you know, it's really not that long of a time considering how massive the scale of that war was, and we shouldn't have another one ever. But the Rothschilds, the big banks are going to make sure that one happens. Of course, there's always things we can try to stop them. But I'm pretty sure that when it comes to there, it's going to be hard to stop this one considering how soon it is. what we can try to do now is spread the information, the lies about this UN war, and that this is not about human rights. Is not this whole narrative about Assad the dictator, Assad's evil. Assad is a madman. We can dispel that. To show some of the good things that he did for his people prior to 2011. I'm going to also show that the rebels, what they've done to the people there, and how the rebels have fought in residential areas intentionally to try to draw the fight in there, as they are pretty much using these people as pawns. And we can also talk about the fact that the Free Syrian Army is aligned with more radical groups, such as Islamic Front, Al-Qaeda, and even loosely ISIS. And we can also talk about the American origins of ISIS. The fact is that ultimately this goes back to the 2000s, and really when you think about it, all terrorism came back from the 1980s when the United States supported the Mujahideen, which now one of the pioneers of Islamic terrorism, Zbigniew Brzezinski, is dead. He actually met with bin Laden personally, and you know, when it comes to the Middle East, it's not someone that's going to be missed. I mean, Zbigniew Brzezinski supported these cold-blooded murderers in Afghanistan. And ultimately, later, the Taliban took power. And there was only really one potential positive of the whole ultimate takeover, I guess you could say, the Taliban in Afghanistan, was when Mohammed Omar was there, that heroin in production went down 99%, supposedly. It was apparently one of the most successful anti-drug programs in history. And then afterwards, the heroin production skyrocketed again. Apparently that was like a large amount of the world's heroin was gone when Mohammed Omar banned the opium production in this country. This is about 17 years ago. And I'm not any way defending that government that was there until 2001. It was ultimately America planting itself. I mean, if you go back far enough, if you go back to the 80s, when the United States supported the Mujahideen, they split off into the Taliban, and they took over the country in 92. And then they, like, reformed themselves again in 96. They made themselves into what was called an Islamic Emirate. And that was the country for like 5 years. That's where the white Islamist flag was over Afghanistan. Nowadays, it's like another American puppet government now elections and everything. And it's not officially a dictatorship. It's like it's like what they were trying to plant in Iraq. It's not officially a dictatorship, even though that the United States has total control of the situation. So ultimately the United States meddling in these different countries in the Middle East has led to no real good. We've seen time in and time out the same formula. They put in a dictator, they put in a puppet, and then years later they might try to remove and put in another one. You saw what happened in Egypt, is that with Mubarak, is that eventually they got tired of Mubarak, so they put in Morsi. And it appears that when Morsi went, now Sisi became the new dictator for America. And while Sisi seems to have some pro-Russia opinions, and when it comes to Syria, seems to be slightly not on a board of regime change as the other ones, Sisi still seems to be an American puppet. And I can't defend what he's done to the Palestinians by blocking the tunnels, going over to Gaza. Now, a lot of my guests are on last week. He was saying that this is just a consequence of that they have to do this. That ultimately, that Egypt, if they did not help Israel fight the Palestinians, that they would be so vulcanized, and they might even take retaliation. But I kind of disagree with that. I feel like they need to make a stand. The Nasser made a stand. I know that led to eventually this country getting invaded. But is it really good to live in fear like that, live in fear of an Israeli attack, or is it better to make a stand? like what Syria's done, is that they were strongly anti-Zionist for many years, and now you see ultimately, unfortunately, though, now they're inflicted with civil war. The only country that really has taken a strong stance against Israel in the Middle East that doesn't have a civil war in their country is Iran. Iran is one of the few peaceful countries in the Middle East, and they have a strong stance against Israel, and also they have a working democracy. They just had an election, actually, where their moderate Rouhani was reelected. It was at one point Amjad Ahmadinejad was looking for his election. However, Amjad Ahmadinejad ultimately he was pretty much forced to drop out by the supreme leader. It was unfortunate, but it's what how. I mean, he was poor. The thing was that they figured that he was too polarizing, I guess, for the Iranian image of the world, is that they wanted to try to put a leader that didn't generate as much controversy as Ajit Aminadab did, which, you know, I feel that in some ways, though, his strong approach to issues and when it comes to Israel, that's what Iran kind of needs in order to try to show that they're not playing around. It's like, I feel like the whole time they're playing soft and trying to get things through military, you know, through peace treaties. It's not the way of politics anymore. Right now we're so close to a major breakout of war that all that kind of went out the window. By the way, another thing that's a current event that's happened, you know, talk about the terrorism, is that in the Philippines now, ISIS has taken over a city in the Philippines, and apparently ISIS has now made some pretty major moves in the Philippines now. There's martial law has been declared by Duterte. It's kind of very serious, which is kind of odd. I mean, I don't think that Duterte is really potentially, is not necessarily against the New World Order. I think there's some things that kind of show that he might be ultimately another New World Order puppet. But this is what he said. President Duterte proclaimed martial law on the southern island of Mindanao, where fighting has been raging between government troops and the insurgents from a local ISIS-linked group since Tuesday. The violence gripped in Malawi, a militant hotbed, prompted Duterte to impose martial law for 60 days with a subsequent warning that he would extend it to the entire country if necessary. However, the decision triggered concerns among many, including a number of Filipino lawmakers. He's conditioned the minds of Filipinos to think that martial law is okay. Now, that's an extreme option. Another Senator, Franklin Verlone, said he doesn't see any basis for Duterte to extend martial law for the entire country. Duterte remains adamant, saying, are they the ones dying and losing blood, bleeding, hemorrhaging, because there is no help, no reinforcements, not them. But it's very unfortunate this happened to the Philippines, that ISIS has made large gains in the country. And, you know, there's some people that are trying to say that this is kind of a repeat of Ferdinand Marcos. So given the abuses which took place during the military rule of Ferdinand Marcos' 1987 constitution, imposed a restriction on martial law, empowered the Supreme Court to martial law, as well as recording the president to get congressional approval to implement the decision. The Supreme Court will say that they examine into the factual basis. Why, I don't know. They are not soldiers. They do not know what's happening, Duterte said. Last Friday, Duterte also said that searches and arrests can be carried out without warrants. During martial law, your commanders, you can arrest any person, search any house, there is no warrant needed, he said. So that contradicts a government statement issued the following day, which said that no person can be detained or put under arrest without orders coming from the civil courts, AFP reports. However, Supreme Court Chief Justice Maria Lourdes Verna said that the country might reap the benefits of the legitimate use of the provisions of martial law in the 1987 Constitution. While addressing students at Ateneo de Manila University on Friday, one properly implemented, this martial law declaration should not by itself unduly burden our country, she said. As the siege of Morawi entered its sixth day on Sunday, the combined number of dead on both sides rose to 100, according to AP. Around 20 civilians and casualties, including three women and one child, have been reported so far, according to the military spokesman, General Astuto. 61 militants, and 11 soldiers and 4 police officers have been killed. So, as you see, the Philippine situation has got pretty severe, which Duterte made some pretty strong anti-American statements, but at the same time, by his own policy, I mean, I can't think that somebody that's, you know, seems to be like a warrior against American imperialism or anything would, you know, take such a brutal stance in his own drug war at home. I mean, this is pretty inhumane what is being done to drug users in the country. You know, these, when it comes to drug addicts, you know, it goes back to the whole thing about you don't treat drug addicts as criminals. That's how you exacerbate a drug problem in the country, and that's why America still has a major drug problem in the country, is that we arrest our drug users and our addicts rather than treating them as patients, rather than treating them as sick with a disease. The American government still puts in, you know, they still put people that smoke marijuana as criminals. And marijuana is not even a dangerous drug, they label those criminals. But the Philippines, they're literally apparently killing drug users, and mainly drug dealers are getting killed, apparently, I guess, by the police. And also there's vigilante justice that's being suggested to be taken out on drug dealers and drug users. Apparently, even like at one point, that Duterte agreed with like a rebel group that they would work towards eliminating drug users, and you know, these are drug pushers. I think Duterte claims that he's not really targeting drug users. Of course, when it comes to that, it might be just a lot of propaganda in order to make him look bad to the world, especially the fact that he seems to want to strengthen ties with Russia, and he wanted to end the long ties between the Philippines and the United States. I just mentioned Ferdinand Marcos. Ferdinand Marcos was an American-supported dictator, just like Suharto, and there's been many American-supported dictators. Pinochet, multiple ones across South America, Bautista, Franco, Salazar, Seco, Diem, and Pachuli. There's been many across the world fascist-supported dictators by the United States since this day they exist. And ultimately, the United States is, I would say, you could say fascist, just not openly fascist, and that's what we've seen in recent years, is that the normalization of fascism, with Donald Trump, I think a lot of that's been kind of normalized. American people don't nearly have the strong stance, I think, that this was to have happened around World War II, when we had just defeated fascism, when they have taken the callous attitude towards it like they do today. By the way, if anybody wants to call in, let me get the call number. Call number for the show is 845-277-9223. 845-277-9223. So, like, I'm so used to the UCY call number that I have to look up the Block Talk call number whenever I do the shows here on Block Talk Radio. But definitely, someone I kind of like airing early. Like doing my show at this time. You know, I mean, I love doing the primetime shows, don't get me wrong. I love that atmosphere to it. And but at the same time, it's nice for a little change. And also, hopefully, I'll be getting more guests down the road from faraway countries. You know, we had a caller from Australia last week. So that was like a new record probably for the first caller ever into a Voice of Rebellion show. We've had callers from Ireland. We've had callers, I think, from we've had some, I think, from like South America, but we've never had one all the way from Australia. That's pretty far away. It's like 10,000 miles away. And, you know, we were talking about Siri last week, and he's like, you know, trying to get a PhD, actually, and this is one of the things that he talks about. So it was a pretty interesting show. If anybody hasn't checked that out, that's on the UCY.TV archives, or you can go over to the YouTube and look up Voice of Rebellion Radio. Yeah, I was actually live last week, so it's kind of weird. It was airing, and at the same time, it was like Sunday here, but it was like Monday, 3 o'clock there, because Australia's time difference is like 16 hours from the United States. But Australia is so many ways similar to the United States. They have a pretty much the same kind of political system where it's all the same shit. And then they have like one funny guy, President Kevin Rudd, that would tweet, and he would be like, it didn't seem like the tweets of a president, and they had kind of like their own female Obama. Said a lot of rhetoric, but also in the end, she was just one more of the same. Now they have Tony Abbott, which is like a Bush-Trump mixture. Yeah, he's pretty much, he thinks he can show up to Russia or whatever, but at the same time, he's not really that tough of a figure, and he's kind of weak. I mean, I think that ultimately Australia, they don't like him. The case of a lot of Western politicians that really our countries don't like them. And that's what's unfortunate, that when the war breaks out, that I think there's going to be a lot of people on the other side that believe that we, the people, were on board with a lot of the stuff, which we weren't. And really, like, I think about it, maybe the only, like, actually generally positive, I don't even think Trudeau has, like, generally positive views up there in Canada. Trudeau is seen as a seen as weak, he's seen as a, you know, another thing is that he almost immediately, once he became president, was talk about the, about standing up to Russia, and he said that he's not going to let, like, Putin bully the West or whatever. I mean, he's a sharp runner. And, you know, the whole idea that Putin's somehow bullying the West or that Putin's taking advantage of the West is absurd. When, ultimately, the West sanctions Russia, the West has put bases all around Russia. Putin is definitely the victim there. You know, and all the people that are struggling because of the sanctions. You know, we have all the people that are struggling because of the West. The sanctions in Russia, I mean, they've done some effects to messing with their economy, but, you know, surprisingly, it's not too bad, actually. They've been able to adjust, and they were actually having somewhat of a recession about 2 years ago, and they snapped out of it. So Russia's been one of the few countries that the West has waged economic war with and didn't have too much of an effect on them. Now, there's been other countries where they've been practically destroyed by economic war, and we've seen that in Zimbabwe, where they have the Zim dollar was pretty much taken out of existence because of economic war. Cuba right now, Trump is apparently still taking a hardline approach against their government. And you know, when it comes to all Latin American governments, he's taking a pretty hardline approach. And you know, I'm thinking, is that going to be Trump's first trophy? Is that he's going to take out one of these Latin American countries? And I think when it comes to Venezuela, I think that Trump's going to pick that country as his trophy. He's going to eliminate that government, and then there'll be something that he'll be able to, like, hey, look, I took out a dictator. I mean, I think that in many ways that's what's leading down to. But the fact is that they haven't been able to eliminate him via coup, via political resistance. So now they're going to try to do it via United States intervention. The opposition in the country is so rabid that they probably will welcome United States airstrike. You know, the Venezuelan opposition, they're pretty much terrorists. they try to paint them as freedom fighters, try to paint them as normal people on American media. But you see actually what they're involved with, and it's kind of actually kind of reminiscent of the riots that happen here in America now. And some people say those are backed by Soros. It's funny that people will say that the riots here in America are backed by Soros, and then the riots down in South America are independent and these are freedom fighters. I think that Soros might be behind both of them. But I think that definitely, you know, the elite have a much bigger interest in causing turmoil down in Venezuela and eliminating their government because their government kicked out the Rothschild. You know, you also see other things, for example, like Tillerson, how he lost a lot of money when Venezuela nationalized their oil. There's a lot of oligarchs that have a interest in a piece of the pie of Venezuela. Venezuela has a larger oil reserve than Saudi Arabia. And it's a country that has been on the watch list of America for 20 years. Hugo Chavez was kind of a strong man that was able to use his character and charisma in order to ward off the American influence of the country. Now, Maduro doesn't have quite the same charisma, and that's why I think it's probably the reason why the opposition has been able to put roots into the average Venezuelan person. But I think that it's going to eventually end up with the government being victorious in the situation. I think that Venezuela will survive these crises. And the Bolivarian movement is very powerful. And the colectivos, I think, are going to be instrumental in order to ward off right-wing violence. But it's definitely becoming no longer, I mean, it's no longer a safe country. Venezuela is at the brink of a civil war, and they're at the brink of a United States intervention. There's riots, there's shootings. You know, it's definitely changed. And, you know, from the time of 2007, May the heyday of the Chavez government, it sucks to see how Venezuela has became victim to the United States regime change. And then it's funny is that how many people will come to the defense of the opposition not knowing who these people are. They just take what the mainstream media has told them these people are as freedom fighters and people seeking justice. And also another thing is people think that all the Venezuelan government officials are so incredibly corrupt. Diosdado Cabello, who by Western Spanish news has been labeled as, you know, this horribly corrupt man's got tentacles everywhere. But ultimately, I think that this is the man that scares the opposition the most because he has the charisma in order to may win another election. I think the PSUV, there's not too many options where they can win an election. But with Diosdado Cabello, they can win an election. And with that kind of charisma, I think it gets things back in order. That's what I think Venezuela kind of needs right now, an ex-military guy, in order to get shit done. Maduro just wasn't really like a character for this situation. And Chavez did pick him to succeed him in late 2012. However, I feel like he did make the wrong decision there. That might have been the only error that he ever did. And by I mean that, the only error that he ever did, I mean that there was the only, you know, when it came to political things, large error that he ever did. I don't think that, you know, that any politician, I don't think that any president is perfect. I don't think that any person's perfect. But definitely no politician, no president is going to be, you know, is going to be even close to perfect. But there's definitely, you know, difference between good people that are politicians versus evil or corrupt people that don't have much interest in the average person. They're just there for the money, or, you know, people that unfortunately, you know, they get threatened. They might have been good people when they went in there, but they get threatened and they ultimately have to play ball from then on out at threat of whatever. You know, I'm sure that they have subtle threats, you know, like the mafia does. Probably pretty scary, I imagine, the first day of president, probably what they show you. They show you the JFK tape or whatever from some angle you've never seen You see the real shooter. You see what really happened to the shooter. You see everything. And they probably tell you at the end, any questions? I imagine that, though, in the end, I think that pretty much any day you have to be from their club to become president. I think that, you know, Obama was from their club. I think Trump is from their club. I think George W. is definitely from their club. Bill Clinton was from their club. Going all the way back, JFK was really, you know, was one of the part of the family. He's one of the Kennedys. However, he rebelled and he was shot for it. I think him and RFK rebelled. They were both killed. RFK was a, you know, he was also, he fought for immigration rights, and he also was, you know, he stood with Cesar Chavez, and RFK was definitely a man of a lot of integrity, and then they ultimately killed him in 1968. Probably would have ended the Vietnam War if he would have became the president, which he was on the fast track of doing. It is weird that the favorite to become president was killed in the summer before the election, and then that set the stage for their man, Richard Nixon, to take power in 1968, which Richard Nixon, by the way, had lost just 8 years prior to JFK in a very, very close election. Ultimately, JFK pretty much won with charisma. Some people also say that with fraud and a few other things, that JFK was able to win. I wonder if that's just a smear tactic in order to try to discredit the JFK name. You know, it's also like the same thing. Like they always bring up how he slept around with Marilyn, which, you know, I don't support infidelity at any level. But, you know, when it comes to a president, I believe that a president, often the alpha male characters, they're going to be prone to probably, you know, sleeping around, especially when it's being thrown at them in every direction. And I'd much rather have my politicians sleeping around with women than these fucking creeps that you see like in England and shit that are, you know, getting too cozy with little boys. I mean, this is fucked up. I see these kind of things about it from MPs over there in England and stuff like that, and some of our own politicians over here in the United States. And I'll actually cringe actually saying our politicians. You know, I should say more like them, as in Washington, D.C. As in the, because Washington, D.C. doesn't represent us. Washington, D.C. is not even really part of America. In fact, I think there's like a legal thing where Washington, D.C. is actually separate from the rest of the United States. It's kind of like a city-state. What's important to know about what's going on right now with the whole Trump-Russia connections is that I think that they're distracted us. While they slide into World War III, we're going to be distracted with this Trump-Russia connection stuff. That's practically went over the heads of Americans that we're near the point of World War III, because all they've been paying attention to is this Trump Putin connection. Is that they're waiting to see this, you know, tape or something that the Russians have on Trump or, you know, whatever. They're trying to say that Russia is controlling Trump 100%, that a lot of his associates are all belong to Trump, all belong to Putin. Most people laughing off from this stuff. Because you think that if he could control our elections, we wouldn't have Obama, we wouldn't have had George W. And I think that if Putin really wanted to place somebody into president, it would be Ron Paul, a guy that's non-interventionist and seems to want to not have a Cold War. Trump seems to want to continue the Cold War. He's still pushing all these little moves to wars in these different countries. He doesn't seem to care whether we're in a Cold War or not. He also doesn't seem to care whether we're in actual war or not when it comes to this alarming trend towards going towards Iran. And if we go to Iran, if the United States military goes into Iran, you can expect potentially millions of American soldiers being killed in that. Iran would be a war that probably would stretch the entire region. it'd be 15 Iraqs. As the Iranian military is much bigger and they have a larger missile arsenal, they have a also very dedicated fighting force. The Iranian military, I think, has more morale than the Iraqi military ever had. The Iraqi military, in fact, in 91, they were just pretty much looking for surrender because they didn't have, like, shoes and clothes. The Iraqi military also was pretty much known by the United States military, probably making it a lot easier for them to strike. The Iranian military is pretty unknown by the United States military. Iran is a whole different game, and anyone that thinks that those are comparable, well, they're mistaken. I think that Syria is even going to be more severe than Iraq. When it comes to the fierceness of the fighting that's been going on, and you're talking about hundreds of thousands have been killed in a few years in Syria. This place is horrific. There's not too many safe places anywhere in Syria, and everywhere is pretty much susceptible to fighting. And all over what? Is that ultimately the Free Syrian Army trying to liberate the country from a dictator? But from my understanding, is that this is a government that built up its people significantly, and these people want to push Sharia law on people. They're the dictators. These people, when it comes to the irony of the Middle East, is that the United States says that they're fighting against dictators, and oftentimes these people are democratically elected, like the president of Iran, democratically elected. Rouhani is democratically elected. Abdulhamidullah was democratically elected. And yet they have the supreme leader that ultimately oversees the country. But it's still, there's still elections. There's no election in Saudi Arabia. There is no women's rights in Saudi Arabia. A country devoid of a lot of modern values that we have here in America. And, you know, America's, it's weird how it works. America, there might not be, you know, there might not be no religious police or whatever or anything like that. But when it comes to obeying the government and also obeying the narratives that the government puts out, if you don't, it's like you've committed blasphemy against the Catholic Church. And I say that because, you know, that was way back in the day, the medieval times, you know, that they would, like, behead you and shit if you talk bad about the Catholic Church. Of course, a long-time corrupt organization. But nowadays, our government has been able to put into the minds of the people that you don't question authority, that everything's in the name of fighting terrorism. That's the thing, is they made it seem like if you don't support the government, then you're a terrorist. And with Trump, you see his supporters that, you know, they pretty much call critics to the to Trump's government as domestic terrorists and stuff like that. That's a word that's being thrown around callously now. And it would happen also under some of the previous governments, is that if you were opposed to Obama and you believe in the idea of the Second Amendment, you might be a domestic terrorist. Domestic terrorist seems to be kind of a new word, but it seems to be like a catch-all towards people that are problematic to the government. And I really hope that don't follow into like the footsteps of Germany and some of these countries in the past that started, you know, neighbors were turning on neighbors. You had the people break down and the government ultimately comes between any interaction. You know, that in some countries that they've had tyrannical governments, the people we stuck together and eventually might have even deposed the government. Here, I see a lot of individual mindsets. People believing that everyone's got to be for themselves and only for themselves. And the whole idea of community starts to go away. And that's one thing they want to get rid of, is the idea of community. We don't know our fucking neighbors, you know? That's alarming. We need to have a little bit more of sense of neighborness and stuff like that. And need, you know, it's like one of the things, like why they can control the food supply, because we don't have community gardens. Why do they control the electric? It's because we don't find ways maybe we could have a community windmill. You know, if we all work together as a community, we could completely bypass the system. But instead, people are totally relying on the system, totally plugged in. And it's like the core of the Matrix, that some people are so hopelessly dependent on the system that they'll fight very hard in order to defend it. Of course, I think that wasn't the exact quote, but you all get the point. And that's what kind of like what we're living in. It's the Matrix, our government, the way that we perceive the world is the Matrix. And it's another thing is that they're trying to put it as it's us versus the world. That's the mentality that they've been able to put into the minds of American people. And, you know, trying to make it seem like we don't have many allies or that we have to do this because the whole world is really against us. And it's kind of the mindset they had in Nazi Germany in the 30s. Was an ultra-nationalistic mindset where the where people actually believed that. People believed that everyone was out to get to Germany. And also another thing is that the jingoistic mindset that we're better than everyone. We can't have that. You know, it's different about pride in your culture.